This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Dr. Morton Marcus, who is a retired professor of economics at Indiana University and is also a very well-noted speaker and writer, is around occasionally with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about his Eye on the Pie columns that he puts out there. And he's joining us for an update. And thank you, Morton, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Well, it looks like that nearly all of the columns you've had out here in the month of January, as we start the new year, have kind of dealt with the pandemic in one way or the other. Let's take on first the column, the recent one that talks about how yesterday's normal is Neverland. What did you mean by that?
Well, the idea that we're going to go back to where we were is just a fantasy that we have.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a tremendous trauma, and we may have, post-traumatic stress disorder in our society. We've been doing things differently. Let me just give you the simplest example.
Okay.
I don't know how many Zoom experiences you've had, but I've had quite a few. Now, I never used anything like that before, and millions of Americans never used anything like that, and Zoom isn't the only one that provides this capability. But we now interact with lots of people through something like Zoom, and that's not going to go away because it's so convenient, and it works, and it works well. I have committee meetings that I attend by Zoom. I have book clubs that I attend by Zoom. It's just a marvelous situation. It's the very best way for me to deal with my relatives because I don't like being with them.
And it's not because you're antisocial. It's just that
don't know my relatives.
Oh, I probably don't. Probably just as well too, I suppose. But the idea is it's not safe to do so, unfortunately, as yet. It's getting a little bit better, but it's not there yet.
That's right. But I think we will continue to use things like Zoom very extensively, because if it means traveling somewhere that we don't want to actually go there, it's inconvenient, we won't have to miss a meeting. We can just join by Zoom. And it's the same way with so many other things. I've been able to use Zoom. I don't know if you are aware, but I run a weekly podcast.
Right.
And we've been able to use Zoom to interview people as far away as Moscow in Russia.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think the current one that you have out there, I was talking with a violinist who lives in Switzerland now. So
Right. And this is just a remarkable thing that was not something in our minds. We were always doing interviews with people coming in to our studio, which is my co-host's dining room,
mm-hmm.
and we would be there face to face with them. Well, that limited us to people who were in Indianapolis or central Indiana. Now we're able to do this with people throughout the world, and it broadens our program, and it helps us get more people who are interesting people doing interesting things, which is what we're looking for.
And I know you mentioned in that particular column about the impact of, which is pretty obvious, the impact on economics in the state, about the average wage costs, rather disparities, and we have also some things too. And you mentioned, we talked briefly here in the moment, about the arts, and we'll get more into that in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
That's a separate column. But you talk about the fact that we have so many different occupation groups, and they're all affected in one way or the other, I guess, by the pandemic.
That isn't quite true.
Okay.
Because there are certain industries and certain kinds of businesses that are actually doing better than they were. Let me just give you one example. The RV industry has been booming with the pandemic because people are saying, we can still be isolated from other people. We can be separated from them by going camping. And people have been buying RVs. The RV industry has been doing very well over there in Elkhart County and several other counties in Indiana. So there are people who are working full-time or overtime in our state. Now, there's not great numbers, but the idea that everybody is suffering just isn't true. I've gotten an awful lot of messages from people who say, I'm retired, I've got a decent pension, and with Social Security, I'm really okay. I don't think I should be getting a stimulus check. Now, that's a, I've been amazed at how many people have written me about that. They feel that, it's an inappropriate thing and that the money ought to go to those most in need. And it's sort of difficult to find out who's in need. And there is a benefit to giving money to people who, quote, don't need it. Because what are they going to do with it? They're basically going to spend it. The amount of money, if you're financially secure and you get a check for $600 or whatever amount it's going to be, that's not a lot of money. And it comes out of sort of out of the blue. And what do? Well, you go out and you buy something. The number of TV sets that have been sold, you know, the big ones that are out there, the 50 and 60 and 75-inch TV sets, it's just amazing, absolutely amazing. Why? Because people've got a little bit of extra money, and they say, well, I'll spend it on a new TV. And what that does is it helps keep lots of businesses growing. Because we have millions of people who, quote, don't need this, who are spending the money that's keeping other people employed.
And going along going along with that, you have a separate column as well, too, talking about this recovery we're starting to see and the impact that maybe it's having on the state government in trying to recoup some of the tax revenue losses that they've had to endure here because of the pandemic.
That's right. That's right. We've had problems with sales tax receipts have not been going up, although sales have been going up. And I don't understand why that is. It may be because there is always a delay in the payment of sales tax relative to when the actual sales takes place. The business does not submit those taxes to the state until, I don't know, it's a month later or it's 3 months later, but it's some period of delay. So the figures that we have are at odds, but I don't know that it's particularly significant. I think it's important to note that because the state hasn't been getting all of the revenue that we might imagine they would get. Yet the state's economy, the state's finances are in fantastic condition. They've been able to maintain a very large surplus, which is quite important. It's a question of being prepared versus taking care of things that are in need but can be somehow postponed. And this is a very difficult decision, and I don't always agree with it. But I think that it's not a bad thing that's going on. The fact that I disagree doesn't necessarily mean that something's bad.
I noticed that you have, in fact, in the latest column, you talk a little bit of, certainly about the impact on the economy from the pandemic. You also mentioned, too, of course, the impact that it has on certain segments of the economy that we maybe visit on occasion for entertainment, but we can't now. We're talking about the arts. In particular, I know that the Indiana Arts Commission has had to rely a lot on endowments from the federal government and the National Endowment for the Arts in particular because they need to help artists and organizations keep going. They've been hit really, really hard.
That's right. But the amount of money that's available from the federal government for this purpose is very limited. $75 million for the entire country is a pittance. It's very little money. And the state of Indiana, I think, got something under $500,000 for their activities. Yeah, it was $504,000, so it's just $500,000.
Yeah.
When you, it's the performing arts that are really hit hard. I write about the Fort Wayne Symphony here, but there are 26 symphony orchestras in the state of Indiana. We've got one right here in Northwest Indiana.
That's right.
They're having enormous difficulties because they have no other source of income unless people are making gifts to them, which they might be doing. But the performing arts are very important because one of Indiana's problems is that we're considered a desert when it comes to the arts and to various cultural issues. If you say you want to attract people who are at the forefront of technology and a variety of matters of that sort, many of them want to be places that have quality museums and have quality performing arts and theater and all of these wonderful things. One of the saddest things about Northwest Indiana is that the wonderful theater that we had there at the Holiday Inn in Merrillville is gone. Mm-hmm. And that has cut out a major venue for the performing arts. And I don't know how many times I've been there and seen people perform who are legends in our society. And it's just a wonderful experience. And it makes being here in Northwest Indiana so much a richer place. And that's gone. Now, that's not because of the pandemic or anything, but that kind of thing hurts. And we need to have these institutions to make Indiana a more attractive place. But these organizations are not getting any of the or sufficient amounts of funds to keep them going. Mm-hmm. It's a tragic situation, and I don't have an answer to it. But I think we need to have the federal government recognize that if you want to give to support communities, it isn't just supporting individuals. You've got to support institutions as well.
Well, certainly it's great to bring up at another time. Of course, you'll have more columns in the Eye on the Pie columns about this. And so we're looking forward to them. And as always, Morton, we thank you very much for being with us today. And we're looking forward to our next conversation. Take care.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. That's Bye-bye. Indiana. Bye now. It's Indiana economist and writer and speaker Morton Marcus. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The month of January is National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. And it's a problem that is not only here in Northwest Indiana, but all across the country. Dr. Kalyani Gopal is the founder and president of the nonprofit Safe Coalition for Human Rights. And she is with us to talk about this very important topic. And thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Absolutely. My pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Well, will you please explain to us what human trafficking is and what types of human trafficking could be found here in Northwest Indiana?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So human trafficking is a recruitment of individuals for the purpose of exploitation. So they use force, they use manipulation, and they use deceit. And it's called the actions, morals, and plan model that they use, where individuals are conned, to use very simple language here, into being trafficked. And trafficking itself is when, for example, a mother might take her child and allow her child to be sexually used by another person in exchange for financial support. So especially if you look at COVID and the situation we're going through right now, mm-hmm. and lots of families are at very, very high risk of losing housing. And so in exchange for turning a blind eye and not seeing what's happening, the family can get financial support. And we call that sextortion. So it's happening, for example, where someone would pay the mother for the diapers, for the childcare, for rent money. In exchange, they exploit the child for sexual purposes. That is human trafficking. That's a classic example of human trafficking that's happening right now. Most people think of human trafficking as kidnapping or some child being brought from a foreign country and being sold here, or it happens in other countries. Not in my backyard, right? It happens everywhere else. It's not happening in my own backyard. It could literally be happening right now at a nearby neighbor's house, and we wouldn't even know.
Does human trafficking only happen, say, in illegal underground opportunities? We think about these with criminal gangs and the like here. It's more beyond that, isn't it?
It's far beyond that. This is happening with regular families. It's happening in schools. For example, in Northwest Indiana, we have the highest rate of sexual abuse, for example, in the state of Indiana, correct? So we have the highest rate. And so what's happening with our kids in school is that they're on TikTok, they're on a whole bunch of apps. There's about 45 apps that people have identified, at least if not more, that these young people are on. And parents are not allowed to go on those apps. So they have secret passwords, they have secret chat rooms. And in all the process, what happens is that they... But what happens is that these young people then are going on these apps. And they're on these apps, they're actually communicating with complete strangers. So you can have someone who's like 14 years old on one of these apps because they're bored, they're home, and actually they have greater access to the internet now than they ever have because they're on it all the time at school. So this is causing a huge problem. And so when they go on these apps, they're then talking to complete strangers who could be actually 45 and 50 years old, but they're telling them they're 16 and 15. And they're very understanding and very kind.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned things like within human trafficking that might be involved with kidnapping and things like that. Does physical violence have to be involved in human trafficking?
Not at all. A lot of it is just kindness and friendship. I know it sounds really strange, but if someone is paying attention to you, you're lonely, you're bored, you don't have much to do at home, or you're being abused at home. That could also be happening. And then this other person on the other side of your internet or your phone or wherever you're speaking to them is able to just listen to you, and they take a year sometimes to groom. So the whole process is called grooming. There's no violence involved. It's a lot of grooming. And what they do is they gradually entice this person into trusting them. Once you develop a child's trust, you then have them. That child, the value of that single child is anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000, depending on how many times you can sell them and how you can sell them. One picture of the child that's uploaded on the internet, you can have $5,000 to $10,000 to $50,000 downloads and make money from that.
Mm-hmm. Do victims of human trafficking self-identify themselves as being a victim of a crime and ask for help immediately, or is it a situation where you have to almost coerce people to tell the truth and tell about their problems?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that question. It's such an important question, and nobody ever asked that question, but they never self-identify. Rarely, if ever, will they tell you they're a victim of human trafficking. And that's the biggest problem we have, because if you don't know that there's a crime being conducted against you, why would you report it? And why would you tell anyone? So what they see themselves as able-bodied, willing participants in the crime that's happened against them. It's almost like the Stockholm Syndrome, right? They think they've helped, that person is kind to them, they're nice to them, and they feel horrible about turning them in. And they also see themselves as willing participants. So the informed consent for 10 and 12-year-olds doesn't really exist because they don't understand the whole concept of informed consent.
Now you mentioned,
and they don't self-identify.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that it's difficult to find how they feel, if they won't admit to being in that situation. How can one spot the signs of human trafficking?
So there's three critical signs that I look for. One of them is a huge level of secrecy. So for parents, for example, they can look for sudden change in friendship, attitude changes, irritability. They're up at night. These kids are anyway up at night watching videos and TikTok and all these other, YouTube. Mm-hmm. But they're up at night on their phones texting constantly. Making appointments, disappearing from home for half an hour, 45 minutes, going and coming back, changing their clothes. They have one set of clothes, another set is in their backpack. Coming in and out of cars. So we had one family where, the trafficker was actually sending the customers to the house. and they were going in and out of the cars at the end of the street or right in front of the house sometimes. So these are changes, sudden changes in behavior, a lot of secrecy, two phones. Sometimes they're always having this particular phone always has to be on them because they get into trouble with the trafficker. Initially, there is no physical punishment for the victim. But as time passes, the physical abuse and emotional abuse occurs. So that it's so addictive that they live for that one moment when the trafficker is going to be nice to them.
I suppose we're also probably talking, too, as you mentioned, even though there may not be any physical violence necessarily, there will certainly be consequences.
Absolutely.
Because you've got very serious sexually transmitted diseases that will come
about. Absolutely. So then, and then these children will not talk about it. And what happens is they get more severely ill. And that's when they find out. That's when parents find out.
What organizations is the Safe Coalition for Human Rights working with here in Northwest Indiana to help in the fight against human trafficking?
Well, we've been very, very fortunate. Northwest Indiana is very aware. I am very proud of being a resident here. We are working with St. Catherine's Hospital. We have a memorandum of agreement and understanding with them. They're working with our survivors of human trafficking. We have a house that the Poor Handmaids of Jesus Christ has literally given us to work on. And we have four residents that are going to be living in the house between 4 to 6. Right now we have 3 and 2 babies. So we have victims of human trafficking staying there. Right now we're the only house that's housing survivors of human trafficking in Northwest Indiana. And we have that organized. So we have St. Catherine's, we have Methodist Hospital helping us out. And we have the Continuum of Care, which oversees 30 organizations in Northwest Indiana. So Dr. Sharon Liggins, who's also a board member, is part of that. We have incredible amount of support. I just got off the call with Sojourner's Truth, and they have we are working with them because they're helping their residents with vouchers and so forth. So it's a very close-knit, a wonderful, wonderful community. We are very, very fortunate here.
You mentioned these safe houses, which is one of the major goals that the coalition is working on, and they're
right.
Just starting out. There aren't nearly as many as there should be, but what kind of efforts, you mentioned some of the organizations that are assisting the coalition here, what can an average person do, for that matter, if they feel they can, to help work towards establishing more safe houses so that victims of human trafficking have someplace literally safe to be?
Well, if they have a house that's available, what an average person can do, for example, if they have a home or they have another home that they're not using and they want to donate it to Safe Coalition, we can transform that home into a housing unit for our victims of trafficking. Victims of trafficking don't look like bag ladies and people out on the streets, and they're not dirty and filthy or anything else. They're actually very lovely young people. They look exactly like us. They don't look any different. And so what they really need is a safe place that they can grow, they can finish their education, they can go to college or learn a trade. You know, many of them are into cosmetology, and one of them actually who's working with us is trying to finish her GED, and she's going to school and she's studying, but she's got learning disabilities, so she needs help with that. So the kind of work that they can support us is tutoring. We always need tutors. We need tutors, we need teachers, we need people who can teach life skills. And if they have actual property, that would be helpful, but they don't have to. You know, someone who wants to volunteer and help, they can call. There's so many areas they can help us with. If they have a marketing background, they can help talk to organizations about supporting these women. You know, we have one person who just donated little care packages. And that was lovely because that's what they need. You know, it seems like shampoo, soap, nothing major.
Are there organizations that are existing right now here in Northwest Indiana? In particular, I'm thinking of the St. Jude House, which is in
Absolutely.
Crown Point. They look particularly to help not only family members who have suffered abuse at the hands of a spouse or other means of abuse, but they have family members who they're very concerned about, and it's a safe place for them to stay, too. Are these groups like
this
a big help, too?
Absolutely. St. Jude is lovely. I've worked with them for the past 20, 25 years. I know them extremely well. The beauty about St. Jude is they're also affiliated with St. Anthony's, so they have their residents go there. They have group homes. They have the group support. They are a shelter, and they only have so many people that they can take in. But the good thing about St. Jude is anyone can walk in there and get help if they're a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault. So, yes, absolutely. They're a great group to work with.
Now, Dr. Gopal, is there any number or a web address that people can go to if they would like to find out more about the Safe Coalition for Human Rights or offer some information or offer their help in volunteering?
Absolutely. If they can go to SAFE, that's Safe Chair, C-H-R, SAFE, like being feeling safe, so safe, CHR.org. They can also call us. We're always accessible. They can call us at 219-513-8508. That's 219-513-8508. They can even email us or stop by our office on Calumet Avenue. Mm-hmm. We are in Munster. It's 9335 Calumet Avenue, Suite D. They're welcome to stop by. We absolutely need volunteers. I myself a volunteer for the organization. None of us get paid. We actually look for individual donations. We look for grants, any kind of support. We've had a lot of support from the Lake Area United Way. They've given us grants. Legacy Foundation has given us grants. And we're also working now with Pinnacle Hospital, which is a private hospital of doctors, but they're also willing to help us and work with us.
Well, it's great to hear that.
So we do need donations. We are very lucky, very fortunate.
It's nice to hear so many people are volunteering and offering what services they feel they can do to help fight the issue of human trafficking. And we thank you for being with us, Dr. Gopal, and talk about this today.
Thank you so much for your time, and thank you to all your listeners as well.
Dr. Kalani Gopal is the founder and president of the nonprofit Safe Coalition for Human Rights. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much, as always, to our guests for being with us today. And coming up on tomorrow's program, we will have Post-Tribune reporters Meredith Colias-Pete and Carol Carlson to talk about the stories that they have put out in print and online in the newspaper. Also, WFYI reporter Hillary Powell will be with us to recount her experience covering the events of January 6th in Washington, D.C., and we'll bring back our conversation with Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser about this coming Saturday's North Township Trustee Caucus. And we hope you can join us for tomorrow's program.